Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, over-exploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I'm pleased to welcome Alex Sung to the podcast. Alex is a data scientist currently working for the Department of Energy National Energy Technology Lab. And previously, Alex worked as a senior research scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas. We both worked together at the Bureau. Today, we're going to focus the discussion on the current status and future directions of artificial intelligence and machine learning in earth sciences, AI/ML. Alex published an excellent review article on how big data and machine learning benefit in the environment and water resources management in Environmental Research Letters in 2019. Thank you so much, Alex, for joining me today.
Yeah, sir, it's my pleasure.
So, Alex, you've been working with AI/ML for, over a decade now and recognize the value of it, and we're all beginning to recognize it more and more. And I guess it's just all around us. Some people think maybe we can just turn it off or whatever, but I think it's too late for that. But even driving around, you see these self-driving electric vehicles and people in their homes, they have Alexa and they're asking questions all the time. Maybe you can describe how some of the concepts for AI/ML are used, say, for example, for the self-driving EVs or things like that.
Yeah, sure. So self-driving technology, that basically is a perfect example for demonstrating how AI and ML is affecting our, everyday lives, right? So if you look at self-driving car, for example, a Tesla, then AI and ML are actually everywhere in the car, and they work all together to help the car drive under this supervision mode, right? Full self-driving cars. And so basically, we talk about AI. Let me probably first define the terms. So we often use AI and ML together. So AI basically is just a generic term referring to the use of computers or machines to imitate human-like behaviors, right? And then ML is actually a branch or subset of AI that train the models to learn or reproduce human behavior or human thinking to solve the real-world problems. So in the case of self-driving car like Waymo or Tesla, then the AI/ML basically work in coordination with the hardware, right? First, the hardware like LiDAR system and GIS system and onboard cameras, right? They capture the real-time information. And then so the online models, for example, like convolutional neural network models, can be used to detect the real objects on the road, and for example, pedestrians and road signs and traffic lights, right? So then that provides the real-time feedback to the onboard processors, and the processor can then make real-time decision on behalf of a human being. And so that's a really almost one of the most complicated AI/ML systems out there, right? So basically, kind of reflect most aspects of what we have achieved in the world of AI/ML from the hardware and software. So this is a great example to basically illustrate how AI/ML has influenced our everyday work. Of course, we have many other examples like smart home Alexa system you just mentioned, and even our smartphones, which can do much more these days. So we're basically living in a world full of those smart things, and it's just impossible to turn them off, like you mentioned.
It's interesting, if you ask anybody in the past, if you go to a new city or whatever, you might ask somebody where such and such a place was or whatever. Now everybody just looks at their smartphone. And even you go to the grocery store and you say, which aisle is blah, 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 and they pull out their phone. So it just seems like it's making us a bit dumb. We don't remember any phone numbers anymore. I hardly remember anybody's name or anything because I can search in my Outlook and figure out what the name is. We're losing some of our memory and outsourcing it to smartphones or to other things. So yeah, thanks for explaining these electric vehicles and how they operate. And another example is a friend of mine was going to a conference and she booked one of these through Uber, but it took her to the wrong conference center. But I think, large language models then are used, I think, to respond to voice commands. So I think we're getting more and more comfortable with these things and maybe somewhat of maybe a bit too comfortable. And then in the homes, Alexa, people have conversations and asking them all sorts of questions. It's sort of addictive, really, to be able to get information so readily in an easy way. So, Alex, you have seen artificial intelligence and machine learning evolve a lot in the last, more than the past decade. And maybe you can describe a little bit to us the different stages it has gone through and how AI and ML evolved along with the computer infrastructure that also evolved to support it and how it was this marriage between the two that has, made some of these things possible today.
Yeah, sure. The research of ML actually started a long time ago, right? So then these days we tend to call those like the classic ML. So the modern deep learning era actually started probably like around 2010. Then between 2010 and I would say 2016, we see this like algorithm dominated era, right? So many deep learning models were developed during that time, such as the convolutional neural net and LSTM. LSTM actually was first developed in 1990s. But all these models got pretty popular in that time. And then starting like around 2019, then we have this attention-based, transformer-based models, right, from the natural language processing. And that's from this famous paper, like attention is all you need. I think that was published around probably 2018. And then after that, then the transformer technology actually has evolved quite much. And essentially, it is serving as basically a backbone for all the modern generative AI models, from language processing to the vision transformer models, right? So then in 2020 and actually just up to a couple of years ago, then we started to see the foundation models, right? So foundation models basically are a generic term that refer to those large capacity machine learning models, for example, transformer-based models. But its unique features are first as a really large capacity, because typical foundation model may have billions of parameters versus the traditional models that we often used before the deep learning era, right? So then the foundation models actually has created a lot of hype or excitement virtually in every field. Now everybody's using the ChatGPT or Copilot. So then starting like a couple of years ago, we see this huge interest from the commercial sector, from all types of investors that want to push this generative AI forward, right? So we see this almost like a fierce competition among the big technology firms like Meta or Google and NVIDIA, and as well as startups from all over the world to compete for the best large language models. And then we basically see those models, like they release a new model almost like every week or never seen before speed. So then in recent years, we keep pushing the barrier or for those large language models. Basically, we want the artificial general intelligence or AGI, right? So that's basically the thing that's really close to human reasoning capability. So basically, in a recent report published by this tech company called Gartner, it mentions that 2026, is a year for AI as an infrastructure. Basically, that means that AI is basically just a Microsoft operating system that's part of everything. And then it's basically pretty normal to work, you know, side by side with some kind of AI driven system. The development is pretty fast paced. Nobody, 2 years ago, probably nobody had imagined this kind of fast pace. And also at the meantime, it's actually the hardware, for example, the GPUs from NVIDIA and TPU from Google and many other startups that basically push all these things forward. So to train bigger and larger models, we need not only more data, but also faster and more powerful hardware system. So it's this waves of algorithm renovation plus the hardware renovation that kind of driven the AI boom we have seen in this past decade.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you didn't think that anybody could envision this 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And I think that's correct. So you mentioned a number of different things there, Alex. The first phase you were talking about in 2010 to 2015, 16, you talked about deep learning works. And so I guess shallow learning, is that like random forest or things like that? And deep learning is, you got a number of different layers and it's much more hierarchical structure. Or what's the difference between what's new about deep learning relative to what we had before deep learning?
Yeah, that's a great question. Shallow learning is mainly about the model capacity, right? So shallow learning, we in the classic machine learning world, we have this support vector machine or random forest or even some kind of linear regression. Those are considered the classic machine learning models. They typically have a relatively small number of model parameters, right? Then in those deep learning models, for example, the convolutional neural net, it basically uses this big stack of feature extracting layers, right? So we're talking about many of those extracting layers with the different reception field. They work together to extract information from the image pixels, you know, at different scales, right? So that's why the term you just mentioned, hierarchical feature system, that kind of automated this feature engineering, because before it's like there's a lot of manual work that tries to find the best feature or predictors that go into the model, right? But with this deep learning models, this feature engineering is semi or fully automated, right? So we provide image or big data set to those models, and then through this hierarchy of different layers, model layers, then we kind of extract a compact representation of the high-dimensional object in the raw, in the original space, right? So this is instrumental, actually, for the multi-AI, because the machines are better in understanding this compact representation of data, high-dimensional data, or high-dimensional image, right? So if we can convert all the objects or, you know, high-dimensional data science, especially in earth science, into this compact representations, then we have this potential to learn the underlying, they call it the latent representation or embedding, that's sort of shared by many different objects, right? So as a casing example, right, let's say if we look at the river basins in the U.S., they all look like very different climatology, different topology, right? But if we use a deep learning model, then we're able to project this all this heterogeneous information in the raw space to a latent space that's relatively small in the dimension, but then that allow deep learning model to learn all these different things more efficiently. So at the end, we can find this generalizable model. So that's represent the common things behind all those different basins, right? So this is very important because it basically enables a single model to be trained and then transferred to many different contexts. In other words, this is what the term generalizable or generalized AI means, right? So you train a single model that becomes like almost context agnostic, then you can apply to basins or to other places where they were not originally included in your training data set. So the automatic feature extraction and hierarchical learning, that's the basis for many of the models we're using today.
Well, and the other term that you mentioned that we will get back to later is the LSTM, long short-term memory, and we'll get back to that application in hydrology soon. I mentioned earlier, Alex, that you wrote an excellent review article for Environmental Research Letters and published it in 2019. And that was back then. If you were doing that same review today, maybe you can describe a little bit how you would use AIML a bit more to do that review and maybe have your agent do half the work.
Yeah, so in 2018, we published that review paper, but that kind of reflected literature, actually 5 years before that, right? Since that time, many things have happened, as I just mentioned, several minutes ago. So if I were to write another, a review now, I think there are many notable things. First thing that comes into my mind, of course, is the large language model and the foundation models behind it, right? So foundation models basically are those models trained with large capacity, but trained with using large volumes of data. So that basically formed basis for the emerging behavior. When your model is scaled to a certain level, then you have the emerging behavior that the model suddenly becomes smarter, right? So then it's able to handle many different tasks, including the tasks that you probably didn't even include during the training, right? Again, using the ChatGPT, now it's actually trained with a large thing called the text prompts. They searched all the texts available on the internet and many other open source texts and then used that to train the model. But after training, the large language model behaves almost like a very smart person, right? It knows a lot, and all based on the context in the natural language and the relations between all these different contexts that it learned during training. So that represents the most exciting development since 2019 review paper. And then the other thing is the modern AI has actually gone beyond the natural language processing, the thing that large language model was originally designed for, right? So this is we have many VLM or vision language model, so that can handle not only text, but videos and images, right? So we call those the multimodal data. I think that's exciting and very relevant to earth science in general, because in earth science, we are facing a lot of this data sparsity problem. In general, we don't have many stream gauges or other types of sensors deployed in the field. On the other hand, we may have remote sensing data, but the resolution sometimes is coarse. But if we can somehow combine the text data, numerical data, and also the image data, then that basically can significantly augment our capability to answer things and do the tasks. And now we have not only better interpretation of the subject of study, for example, that during flood time, the trained foundation model may be able to recognize the flood level image and also may search the social media for the text. And then the model can synthesize all these different sources of multimodal data to arrive at some kind of real-time decision support for the evacuation. So this is very exciting, especially for earth science and hydrology. And the third one is also related to new capabilities shown by this new generation of foundation models, right? So this is like a agentic AI. That means we can train AI agents to do different things. For example, in a typical task, GIS analysis task, for example, we need to gather different maps from different sources, and then we want to clip some sub area for the area of study, and then we manually look at those different layers and then perform some calculation and then get some conclusions. So about where to, for example, to find new mineral sources or where to drill new wells or stuff like that. But with this agentic AI, it's basically AI augmented pipeline system. It helps us to first, divide this whole task into many subtasks, right? And then this is usually called the planner in the agentic AI world. Then the planner delegates the subtasks to different agents, right? So for example, the GIS analysis agent that can extract or gather and extract the maps. And then the analysis agent can then analyze the maps, including extracting the object directly from the raster maps to find the objects we're interested in. All these agents, when they work together, they basically can replace many of the systems we're using today. So this is very exciting on one hand, but it's also pretty scary on the other hand, because if you see in the news these days, many people are concerned about traditional jobs, right? Whether they will still exist if we deploy the agentic AIs everywhere. So those are the major things I can think of since we wrote the 2019 review paper.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Alex. And my impression of AI and machine learning is that you can throw the kitchen sink at the problem, and an AI can handle so many different types of data. And you mentioned text and images and social media. And when we had the flooding in July in Texas, and we had some meetings afterwards with David Maidment and some other groups, one of the groups was talking about a system that they were developing in Virginia, GPS system that you use in your car, and that it would help with flooding. And so if people saw the flood level or whatever, then they would feed back, and then the next people would know. Like people say, where there's police, and the feedback you get from crowdsourcing data or other things. So I really, it's extremely powerful. And then this agentic AI seemed like you basically have an army working for you. And a colleague was describing to me recently that they were using cloud code development and describing in detail what they wanted it to do. And so then it would just go out, and instead of just writing code and numerical code in the traditional way, it would describe it in detail. And then it would, the cloud code developer, then it would go through all those steps and do it all. Of course, you have to verify and validate and all that sort of thing. And I think that gets back to the review article that you wrote, Alex, which was big data and IML. We need a lot of data, but it can handle a lot of data. And so I guess one of the things that you mentioned is the flooding. So operational flood management and evacuation and all of that, it seemed like we cannot rely on the traditional approaches, and the latency might be too much and we really need AIML to handle all of the remote sensing data and all of the data that's coming in from social media and all of these things to try to manage hazards like flooding or earthquakes or all of these things.
Yeah, that's right. So flooding is actually one of the most, I would say, developed area because it's the huge damage, is economic damage it causes every year, right? And this we see interest not just from academic world, but also from the like big tech firms like such as Amazon or Google, right? So I think Google now runs this thing called the Flood Hub, where it basically you know, aggregates the information from the many different sources for the, at a global scale. So this is a very important application toward hazard mitigation and to potentially save many lives. So this is also very exciting in terms of the AI's social impact, right? So it's not just for explaining certain natural phenomena, but also to be used in operational manner to also reduce latency related to the traditional operational systems, right? So I think that's the application of AI. That's something that's going to continue to add value to our everyday lives.
Yeah, and because sometimes when I look at insurance reports and stuff like Aon or others, and they'll say we might have more hazards, but the mortality is not as high as it used to be and things like that, to help reduce anything that we can do would be valuable. And you mentioned that people are concerned about jobs and AIML taking jobs. But my feeling is that more will be expected of us. You know, AI and machine learning will free up our minds from certain tasks like maybe data cleansing, wrangling or whatever, and preparing data and writing code and things like that. But then we'll be expected to do more because we can never seem to get ahead. Long ago, I would have to go to the library to get my papers to read. And now they're readily available, but there are more out of them. And so they're expected to read more or whatever. So I'm not too concerned about job loss, but maybe certain jobs may be more vulnerable than others.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, definitely. You know, myself, I have benefited from the improved productivity because the use of AI and all those chatbots to come up with some basic code and stuff like that. So that's a plus, but I also agree with you that we probably have more work to do to safeguard the results of AI, right? So as a domain scientist, I think that's a very important job to look after results or whatever outcomes generated by AI and make sense of the AI-generated decisions. And I think by providing this human feedback to the large language model reasoning system, I'm hoping that we can generate more useful and more valuable information than before, right? In the old style, we look at paper, we do some research, and we think ourselves. But now it's like many virtual agents that works side by side with us and help us to think more comprehensively. And to me, I think that's very important because there's always something that we don't know, right? So I think that's a very important aspect going forward.
And a kind of a side issue, Alex, since we're both hydrologists, is the resource intensity of AIML. How much energy, electricity it uses, how much water it uses. And I was just looking the other day and one paper suggested like 10 to 50 medium-sized large language model queries would use up about a half a liter of water and maybe 50 watt hours of electricity. That would be equivalent to running an LED bulb for about a few hours. People are scrolling 24/7. You see it all the time. And I don't think people are aware. And maybe we can manage it. You know, we have large data centers and electricity demands and stuff like that. But I think maybe with time, maybe people will become more cognizant of the actual resources that are used for these processes.
Yeah, so that is indeed a major concern right now, the energy consumption that's needed for training, you know, all those large language models. And it takes millions of dollars, that's what I heard, to train a large language model. And it's mainly related to the computing hours. You basically need a lot of computing power to process all the data. So that represents a significant power consumption. It's just like, you know, we're sitting there, we ask questions, but without realizing how much power was used to train those models. That's also a major bottleneck because in terms of investment, I mentioned foundation model, one of the features emerging behavior, like by scaling up your data, you start to see this new behavior that's not observed when the data volume is small. But more recent findings are like this scaling up has probably hit a plateau. You know, after the companies crawled all the web techs and used all the open source code repositories or documents they can find, and there's basically no more good label data to use to train those models, right? So then this is what they call the scaling up plateau. And it is like the major bottleneck for basically going to the next level of AI. And with this, the scale of the model we're seeing right now, if you spend more CPU or GPU hours to train those models, the return is actually marginal. And I think that's a dilemma, not just for the companies, but also for the investors. So that, and combined with this energy consumption, I think those are the major concerns of the AIML developers right now, how to reduce power consumption and how to break the data limitation. I think that's a very active area of research, and the outcome of that research basically will lead to the next generation of even smarter AI models.
Alex, one of the things I think of is there's so many things happening, and as you mentioned, it's very dynamic, things happening so fast, and you just feel like saying, oh my gosh, you know, just throw up your hands and you say, I just can't keep up, you know. But one of the things when we were chatting the other day, you mentioned is that some of the fundamental AI concepts and ideas and stuff are very powerful, and they haven't changed. Maybe they've been modified a little bit, like you mentioned, long short-term memory or random forest or variations of these. Maybe you can describe a little bit about some of those fundamental aspects and how they're still there, and that we may be looking at variations of those, but it's not just off the scale, out of the box, you know, all the time, changing so much.
Yeah, you know, long short-term memory model is actually pretty interesting. I think the original concept was probably introduced in the mid-90s. So there was a reason it got popular in hydrology, because a serious paper published by some U.S. and German researchers, right? So it basically took this U.S. National Gauge data set, and then to show that they were able to train this single LSTM model to basically give reasonable predictions for all gauges in the data set, right? So since that time, we have seen new researchers have tried the newer model architectures, like, you know, transformer, but still, the LSTM represents at least very close to state-of-the-art performance. I think that's because in terms of architecture, the design of LSTM resembles actually the hydrologic processes. It represents the storage component, the memory of the hydro system, and also the delayed response because of the rainfall runoff and rotting process, right? So it has these different components that mimics the physical process. So that basically enable it to model this rainfall runoff process effectively. I think that basically also echoes what you just mentioned, that the newer is not necessarily better, right? So I think especially for hydrology and the natural science in general, we have a lot of this physics-informed paradigm, right? So it's not just data-driven, but we want to incorporate our physics models and the prior knowledge into the modeling process. That way, we learn not just the data itself, but also the underlying process, right? That sort of makes more physical sense to us. I think in terms of application, all these models can coexist. Depending on the context of their application, we can choose one model from many possible candidates. So that way, actually, we can also reduce the power consumption, right? Instead of training huge model that requires a lot of GPU hours, right? We may be able to just train a small model efficiently while providing essentially same accuracy. So I think this capability to choose from different model architectures or even to combine different model architectures represent a very interesting research that's often overlooked, because in academia, it's oftentimes that we have to publish a new algorithm that beat the existing algorithm, right? But on the other hand, we can train many of the existing models and use an ensemble of those models to give us very reasonable or actually sometimes even more accurate answers. You know, this is basically the classic concept of ensemble learning, right? So we use the ensemble models to generate more accurate predictions and also give us this capability to quantify the authority in the model predictions. Going back to the model question, you know, I think basically we can live with different models and we just have a much wider set of tools to choose from these days.
Yeah, I think you mentioned LSTM, long short-term memory, you know, and how that mimics the physical system. So you input the rainfall and you estimate the runoff, or you could estimate the soil moisture or whatever, but that the memory in that system then replicates what happens when the rainfall infiltrates into the soil moisture and then becomes runoff and things like that. So that's a really powerful approach. And that's why it's very valuable, will probably continue to be valuable for forever. And then, you know, a lot of people say AI, ML models, data-driven models, black box, not truly interpretable. But then you say, okay, let's bring in some of the physical constraints. So even if the data suggests that the water is moving uphill, we just say the water needs to move downhill and put in some of those constraints and have a physics-informed machine learning. So, and then even the data-driven models may give us some ideas and stuff and concepts that we wouldn't have thought of from the traditional physics models. And then you mentioned the ensemble. If you want to run 1,000 models or whatever, the traditional physics-informed models might take forever. And reduced order models, you know, more simple models or are data driven, or we might be able to run 1,000, and then we might be able to get much better uncertainty quantification with all of those models looking at that large ensemble, and also may be able to sample extreme events, because seems like what we're dealing more and more in hydrology is extreme droughts, extreme floods, and trying to sample that just from a single set of observations from a region, you know, what you have experienced is just one example of what could have happened. But with the ensemble, then you can generate a zillion of them that are consistent with what you've seen and all of that sort of thing. So another example, Alex, where we really need big data in AIML is remote sensing. And maybe you can describe a little bit the value of it. You know, oftentimes remote sensing data, satellite data, we have some data that's high spatial but low temporal resolution, or vice versa. And we're trying to combine these, or we're trying to look at land use, land cover change, or stream flow, or all of these different types of parameters. Maybe you can describe that a little bit.
Yeah, remote sensing basically represents a big source of big data. That's something we actually focused on a lot in the 2019 review paper, right? So like with so many satellites and the long-term archives from many of those satellites, like Landsat, right? So they represent very important source of information for Earth science. But traditionally, the remote sensing faces several challenges, the data retrieval problem and the missing data problem, and also most importantly, the data resolution problem, right? So many data to come in different resolution and representing different techniques. So the big question is how to homogenize remote sensing data, right? So that's something that the recent development of foundation models can do very well. And for example, Google recently published this Alpha Earth foundation model. Basically, it looks at all the, you know, different satellite data collections that it already has through Google Earth. And then it combined all this data, you know, at a very high resolution and using the representation or embedding technique that I mentioned at the beginning. So that's something all the deep learning models use. So they basically project all the most interesting data they have from NetNet, from other sources, right? And then they divide the whole planet into a very high resolution 2 meter by 2 meter pixels, right? And then for each of this cell, they are able to learn the low dimensional representation, which is basically a vector that reflects all the remote sensing imagery that they have. So basically, it's significant dot scaling process, right? So by using all the different sources of data, they homogenize it and comes up with this very effective representation. So then that means for the local or downstream applications, we can take the latent representation map and then we can use that as our predictors, and then we can train our own model to achieve certain tasks. So that way, it basically establishes a bridge between the huge amount of node sensing data and also the local applications, right? So this is a very good example of how big data and large data help the local scale applications. So right now, I think there's a lot of interest in these applications. You know, for example, Google itself also published the Earth AI model. So the model is built on the Alpha Earth, the foundation model, but it also combines their own Gemini large language model. Then in that sense, you know, we can ask the Earth AI new questions, just like what we would ask ChatGPT or other chatbots. And then the underneath system, the Gemini can do some spatial reasoning and automate a lot of tasks all through the natural language query, right, from us. So I think that basically opens a new window for downstream applications, like basically significantly reduce the time and requires to retrieve all satellite data, and also it provides a very intelligent way to do some applications using the multi-source of data. I think in the next couple of years, that will dominate many of the applications, especially related to, you know, the hazard prevention, right? So by having this high resolution representation of the Earth, including climatology and vegetation and land surface, we can significantly extract more information about the upcoming events, right? For example, during the flooding. So yeah, that's very good direction of your new development in terms of AI.
And I think that kind of reflects, you know, if you're working on any problem and you focus on a single set of data, whatever, people would always say, well, have you considered these data? And so by providing this, then infusing all these different data sources, Google has provided a platform then, and then we can use that to look at, as you said, flooding or wildfire risk or other things. And if you don't use data like that, then people would say, well, you're missing the boat with a lot of different types of data sources. And I think maybe another example would be NASA's Harmonized Landsat Sentinel data, where they combine Landsat with a high spatial 30-meter and low temporal 16-day resolution with Sentinel that has lower spatial and higher temporal resolution. So, and providing these data for free is just incredible and allows us to advance the science. We forget that we didn't always have these things. And so NASA and European Space Agency and all of these different groups that are providing these data is just like a Christmas every day. You know? Is there anything else that you would like to, I mean, AIML is such a huge topic, Alex, and I really appreciate your tackling it. And it's great to see all the work that you have done over the years in this area. And I think, you know, what we've tried to do in this podcast is introduce some of the concepts and describe a little bit the evolution and maybe some ideas about where it's going. And we also provide highlights on the website with links to papers and data sources and definitions and stuff for people who are interested in those details. Is there anything else you would like to add at this point, Alex?
No, I think we have covered many things. They had, like you mentioned, the AI ML is such a big field. You know, I am always hesitant to give any type of talk because it's just too much. But anyway, I'm hoping the information and the topics we covered today can at least benefit our peers or colleagues. So in that sense, you know, I'm very glad that you gave me this opportunity to talk about something.
It sort of reminds me, Alex, it just makes me laugh. I wrote a review article many years ago, and one of the reviewers of the article said, I didn't know much about this topic to begin with, but I knew even less after I read this your review article. So I hope we haven't created that situation. But our guest today is Alex Sun. Alex is a data scientist working at the Department of Energy, National Energy Technology Lab, and previously worked with us at the Bureau for many years. Thank you so much, Alex, for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.